Before we get into today's episode, I want to let you know about a free ebook for you to download today that you won't want to miss. It's called In Conversation with Jordan Peterson, Atheism, Christianity, and the Psychology of Belief. This special ebook was created from an unbelievable podcast with famed Canadian psychologist Jordan Peterson. And in it, you'll discover how to bring order to a chaotic world using the wisdom of the Bible. So download your free copy of In Conversation with Jordan Peterson by visiting premierinsight.org/resources. That's premierinsight.org/resources. This is a limited time offer, so make sure to do it today. That's premierinsight.org/resources. And now it's time for today's podcast.
Good afternoon. Welcome along to Unbelievable. I'm Justin Brierley, your host for the next hour and a half or so here on the show, part of our Saturday afternoon programming of Faith Explored that brings Christians and non-Christians together. And what a stonker, what a humdinger of a debate I have for you today. My guests are going to be atheist Peter Boghossian and Christian philosopher Tim McGrew. And we're going to be looking at Peter Boghossian's new book called A Manual for Creating Atheists. More on that in just a moment's time. Firstly, if you want to get in touch with the show today, we'll be giving out the ways to do that and hearing some of your feedback towards the end of today's program. And of course, if you want to find out about Unbelievable, the conference 2014, you can go to the webpage of the show, premier.org.uk/unbelievable, or directly to the event page. It's happening on Saturday, the 12th of July, Westminster Central Hall in central London. It's going to be a fabulous day with loads of speakers talking about why Christians can be confident in their faith and helping to train and equip Christians who want answers to tough questions. People like Dr. William Lane Craig, Oz Guinness, Tanya Walker, David Robertson, Craig Hazen, Clay Jones, Jeff Zwierink. It's all going on alongside Biola University, who are bringing some of the speakers over, and indeed Reasons to Believe. And we hope you can come. So the event page, if you want to book in for Saturday, the 12th of July, is premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Really is going to be a fantastic day. We've got special offers on tickets. There's if you buy two or more, you'll get a special DVD courtesy of Biola and lots more. So do check it out. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Only 7 weeks away now. Okay, let's get into today's show, tell you what's coming up. You're unbelievable. Well, today on the programme we're asking, is faith a false epistemology? Dr. Peter Boghossian works in philosophy at Portland State University. He's emerged recently as a leading voice in atheism, and his recent book, A Manual for Creating Atheists, has been creating quite a stir. He's encouraged atheists to engage in street epistemology, learn how to talk believers out of their faith. He calls it a false epistemology. Well, in conversation today with Peter Boghossian is Dr. Tim McGrew, professor at Western Michigan University. He's a Christian philosopher. His main area of research for a number of years has been on epistemology, which, put simply, is how we come to know things. In fact, he knows so much about it, he's actually written articles and books on it. His recent article on evidence was in the Routledge Companion to Epistemology. He's written books, The Foundations of Knowledge, Internalism and Epistemology, and more. You can find out more about him at Western Michigan University, where he has a faculty page. Thank you very much, first of all, Tim, for joining me on the program today.
Great to be here.
It's great to have you. I've wanted to have you on for quite a while, actually. Your name seems to come around in some of the circles that I move in. Just give us a brief background to you in terms of your Christian faith and how that worked itself out in terms of your role in academia now.
Sure. Well, I, like many young people, I was raised in a Christian home, and also like many young people, I had my questions about the truth of what I had been taught when I was in high school and early college, and so I started investigating that, and fortunately, I found answers that seemed to me to be intellectually respectable and cogent. However, I also realized that in order to be able to address skeptical questions at the ground level, I was going to have to go into the study of philosophy. And so that prompted an interest in epistemology and the philosophy of science. And that was, for me, a major focus for over a decade, until about a decade ago, some friends began asking me to turn my attention to some of the philosophy of religion literature where there were some things going on involving probability theory. And so that brought me back into this and rekindled my interest in this issue. And so along with my day job, as it were, of teaching logic and probability theory and epistemology and the history and philosophy of science, I've begun working some in the areas of the historical reliability of the Gospels in particular, and also some work on the fine-tuning argument and some other things like that. So that's really been how I came full circle back to some of the issues that prompted my interest in epistemology in the first place. And so that's, I guess, why I'm here today.
Do you feel that academic stuff is filtering down at some level, or are there still very much a popular misconception of what faith is or the rational intelligibility of Christianity and so on?
Well, I very much fear that it's not filtering down, and that what goes on in internet discussions is sometimes rather shockingly disconnected from what goes on in the academy. I suppose that we're all aware that it's just possible that someone on the internet is wrong about something, but it does sometimes cause me a certain amount of puzzlement to see the things that certain people say, the things that they take to be cutting edge and current, and I look at these things and I say that these have been bypassed now and the literature has moved on for 30, 35 years. Why are we still talking about these categories? And yet, there it is. We cannot choose what other people will find interesting or what they will think important. We have to engage them where they are. So I guess there is a role for people who take a professional interest in these things to come sometimes to the table and sit down and talk with people whose main work is on the internet and see if we can perhaps increase understanding of some of these issues and some of the key concepts.
Great to have you with us, Tim. Well, it's a great pleasure to be joined as well on the line today by our other guest for today's program, Dr. Peter Boghossian. He, as I say, works in philosophy at Portland State University and is the writer of this recent book, A Manual for Creating Atheists. It's been creating quite a stir, and we're asking today, as I mentioned on the show, is faith a false epistemology? And Peter, welcome along to the program today.
Thank you so much for having me. I appreciate it, and thanks to Tim for joining me.
Yeah, well, I've had a number of people, listeners of both Christian and atheist variety, who have said, you should get Peter Boghossian on. You know, he's written this really interesting book. So I'm really glad we've been able to make it happen. You say you've not had that many invitations, though, generally, from Christians to do these kinds of dialogues.
No, only Phil Vischer. And that's why I wanted the VeggieTales guy. That's why I wanted to sincerely thank you. And I did so over Twitter and my Facebook, et cetera, for having me on. I appreciate it. And also, if there are other people listening to this who own Christian or run Christian podcasts or Christian radio, I'd like to let you know that I'm available to come on your show free of charge. My school year is very, very difficult to fit in, but the summers are, I don't teach during the summer. It's much easier.
Great, great. Well, look, who knows? Maybe we can get you on again at some point. I know there's lots we want to try and discuss in the course of today's show, because your book has kind of raised a whole heap of interest, especially. I mean, it's got, quite a grabbing title, A Manual for Creating Atheists. Are you interested in, as it were, evangelistic atheism in that sense?
No, I wanted to name the book. The title of the book originally was Street Epistemology, but I was told that nobody in their right mind would buy a book called Street Epistemology. So the goal, that's actually not the goal, that's a consequence of helping people to think more clearly and be more rational and be more reasonable.
Even so, I have heard you're encouraging atheists to kind of engage in so-called street epistemology. So what is street epistemology then?
Okay, before I say that, I just want to go back to, what you had mentioned before. Really, the goal in my writing the book is I wanted to write a book that reflected the types of conversations that believers have in everyday life. And the book is specifically geared to how people actually talk to each other. And I wanted to get away from what some people call, I don't know if you've heard the term from Jerry Coyne, sophisticated theology, which is a type of purposeful obfuscation. And Dennett gives a great example of this, and let me coin the term adipity. And it's basically when language is used to give a false sense of something being profound, but it's it's actually trivial. The example he gives is love is just a four-letter word. But in the book, I write about this in Chapter 2, theology is filled with deepities, and I don't want to engage in a type of obfuscation because I have no respect for it. When people use words in a language to purposely obfuscate what they have to say, that's a type of insincerity. So I wanted to write a book that addressed real people about how real people have conversations. And I wanted that. I wanted to talk to people authentically because I think authenticity and plain spokenness and lack of obfuscation of virtues, and that's what I try to do in my book, to speak very plainly and very clearly to people and not obfuscate.
And in your view, the way that believers will respond when they're challenged on their thinking in clear terms, in those sort of the way people talk to each other normally, it will result in them being, as it were, stripped of their belief in God.
Well, the goal of the book is to disabuse people of bad ways of thinking and superstitious belief. But the goal of the book is really also to help people lead more thoughtful, more examined lives, and to be less capricious and to be more careful about how they use certain words, specifically the word faith. But other words too, hope, trust, confidence, things like that.
But in that sense, then, are you interested in a kind of... what I've heard, I suppose, Peter, is you're encouraging atheists to go, you know, to the places where Christians congregate to use this method and to kind of essentially talk them out of their faith. Is that a fair analysis of what you're hoping might be the end goal of this book?
So that's a consequence or a byproduct of what I'd like to. So there have been so many books written. Mormons have a whole really interesting line of literature on this, but there have been a lot of books written called Relationship Evangelism. I'm sure you and Tim will know far more about that than I do, that teach people how to talk people into faith. And I wanted to write a book, and I have written a book, that teaches, and my public lectures as well, teaches people how to talk people out of faith and how to think and what that actually means and what the consequences for that are. And so the book equips people with an array of dialectical tools by which to engage people of faith in a respectful, sincere, thoughtful, and honest way. Because right now, and I know you're in the UK, right?
Yeah.
So our discourse has become increasingly uncivil, and we've become increasingly polarized, and that's an enormous problem. And if you watch any of the Q&As from my video, or if you watch the Phil Vischer podcast, you see that there are ways that people who have very substantive epistemological, metaphysical, and even moral disagreements can engage people in a way that's civil. And I'd like to – that was the other point of the book. Nobody wants this to become a war zone where people get killed about their beliefs. Nobody wants any more hostility.
Sure. Yeah, absolutely. Well, time to bring Tim McGrew back into the conversation at this point. And I want you guys to feel free to be frank with each other. This is an honest exchange of opinions. But what Tim, did you make of the book? You've had a chance to read it. What's your overall impression?
Right. Well, to be honest, I found a lot of it very puzzling. There are a lot of terms that are getting defined in some irregular ways. And I thought that was maybe... not the best way to go about starting having a conversation, and particularly I thought that the definition of faith being given right up at the beginning, you know, in the chapter 2, you start talking about definitions of faith, and I found those really puzzling in a lot of ways. They're non-standard. I don't know anyone who, outside of you and perhaps your following online, who would define faith as pretending to know things you don't know. And so I found that a really puzzling start, and a lot of the work then is predicated on that definition.
Yeah.
Yeah, there are two, that's the second definition, and Tim's right, Tim writes chapter 2. I also defined the primary definition was belief without evidence, and what I had said before is that I'm really interested in how people use the word faith. And I've taught literally tens of thousands of students and talked to people at all walks of life, and this is exactly how they use the word faith, is unevidenced belief. I don't think that my experience is unique, but we can certainly let the listeners reflect on their experience. I mean, many, many people I've spoken to for whom this usage is very, very standard, not the pretending, but the belief without evidence. And this is how literally billions of people use the word faith this way, and that's what I wrote about, how people use the word.
So do you not stand by the definition of that you do also give of faith is pretending to know things you don't know, or do you think that is also a valid definition of faith?
I think it's a very valid definition. It's not the primary definition of faith. It's the secondary definition of faith. The primary definition of faith is belief without evidence.
Yeah. Tim, what's your problem with that particular definition of faith and indeed the other?
Yeah, well, I've got a whole bunch of problems with that. First of all, Peter says this is how billions of people use the word. Not in my experience. In my experience, you know, maybe Ambrose Bierce and Mark Twain used it that way as a satirical bit, as a joke. But here you're taking a term with a reasonably well-established semantic range, and you're substituting for it a definition that no serious believer has ever endorsed or ever would. We can go, if we want to just have lexical definition, we can go to the OED, which has surveyed actual usage, and the primary definition there is complete trust or confidence in someone or something. And I think that's fine, and that goes back to a New Testament usage of the word pistis as trust, which is a very common meaning for it throughout the New Testament. I also think that it erases the difference between definition and description, and I have a real problem with erasing that definition. You know, there's the old joke about the quote-unquote definition of a human being as a featherless biped with broad toenails. Well, that might describe human beings, but it's a lousy definition. I also worry one more thing.
You're tossing a lot at me.
Why don't you respond to that, and then we'll go on. Yeah.
Okay. Do you want to respond to one or two of the things that Tim's brought up?
Sure.
There,
sure. Yeah. I have absolutely no doubt whatsoever. And in Tim's universe, the academic universe, that there are a small number of people, I don't know how many, 50 or 100 people use the term this way, but the vast majority of people on planet Earth do not. So I guess my question for you, Tim, you know, I've frequently been told by Christians, you have faith in evolution. So what do you think Christians mean by that?
Okay, so, let me just do two things. First of all, I'm sorry, I just disagree. I don't think the vast majority of people use this to mean belief without evidence. And I have a wider circle of acquaintances than merely academic colleagues. You know, I'm online too, and I talk with a lot of people, all of whom are puzzled. Your interviewer, the good atheist a couple of years ago, was very puzzled by your usage, and he's on your team. And he's not an academic, he's an autodidact, and he tried about 48 minutes into the interview to get you to come around. If this were the dominant usage, I think it's quite a puzzle that the lexicographers who write the dictionaries haven't picked up on it. So I am going to disagree there. On the question of people who tell you you have faith in evolution, I think that what they mean is you're trusting in something that you cannot completely verify because it doesn't lie open to your senses there. And I see that as innocuous. I think you could just say, well, if that's all that you mean, okay, but then that's not something epistemically disreputable, and I've got lots of evidence, and what evidence do you have? And then we could move the conversation profitably to a question of evidence rather than being caught on this semantic merry-go-round.
Okay,
yeah.
So this is where we need to slow down, and we need to talk about terms and how people actually use terms. And there are 9 chapters in the book. The first chapter doesn't have any interventions, but chapters 2 through 9 have interventions that people can look at. So when I have been told, and not only I'm not an evolutionary biologist, as you know, but I've been told you have faith in evolution. Dawkins has been told that he has faith in evolution. Jerry Coyne, another evolutionary biologist, has been told that he has faith in evolution. So I think when people use that term, when Christians use that term, they mean that one is assigning a confidence value to a belief higher than what's warranted by the evidence. And so not only is that a common way that people use the word, and I have to say, either you're extraordinarily isolated from that, because that absolutely positively does not ring from my experience of having done this every single day with thousands of believers. But again, you know, we'll let the listeners decide. And I also want to say that that's also how prominent Christians use the word, too.
Okay, so let me address that. You're saying now that people are using the word to mean assigning a confidence that is higher than the the evidence warrants. And by the evidence, I presume you mean the publicly available evidence. But that is not the same thing as belief without evidence, is it? I mean, in the one case, there's no evidence on the table. On the other, there's a room for there to be some evidence. And then the question is your confidence higher than is warranted by that evidence? So there is a distinction there, isn't there?
Yeah, there is. That is absolutely positively a distinction. So, and we can look at that phrase both ways, using both the confidence value that's been assigned to belief higher than is warranted by the evidence. It's a clunky phrase. Or we can look at that phrase of how people actually use you have faith in evolution. You don't have evidence for your belief in evolution, but, and I talk about faith in the book as just believing anyway, but you just believe in evolution anyway. But that's how people use the word. That's what they mean by the word.
Yeah, I mean,
so when you ask them, or have you asked them, do you mean that I have no evidence for my belief in evolution? If you ask them that, have you done so? And if you have, what have they said in response? This is interesting to me. I would like to know if you've asked them that question.
Yeah, I've asked them that question. I've asked people variations of that question with confidence, with hope, with trust. There is no one standard Christian answer to that. There's no one response that one gets. Christianity isn't this monolithic thing, this monolithic religion in which there's only one answer to a question. But I can give you a range of answers, and then I'd actually like to talk about how faith leaders use the word, and it's exactly how they use the word.
Okay, given that you also have this definition of faith as pretending to know things you don't know, I think some believers and Christians maybe feel that's a bit of a low blow at some level, Peter, that you're kind of essentially saying Christianity is basically founded on lying, essentially. That might be the impression that someone comes away with, let's say. Is that what you're trying to say?
So I'm happy to talk about that, but can we just talk about this definition more? Because I think that this is, I don't have to worry with Tim putting words in his mouth because he'll tell me immediately. I think that this is the main point of contention.
It is, yes. I mean, this definition of faith is probably the thing that's been most talked about as far as I can see in the book.
So Tim, what do you think, what's that guy's name, Frank Turek and Guy, so what do you think they meant when they said, I don't have enough faith to be an atheist, when they wrote a book about that? What do you think they meant by that?
Right. I think what they mean is that there's a debased sense of the word faith that's gone around, and it's been picked up by mostly by critics to mean a belief in something in the face of certain difficulties. And they say, well, if it's a matter of comparing the difficulties on the one side and comparing the difficulties on the other, there are greater difficulties lying on the one side than on the other. But I think that that's also partly a bit of a concession to a debased sense of the word that has got mostly prominence in atheist and free-thinking circles. And so they're picking up on that aspect of the semantic range of it and saying, well, if that's how you're going to use it, if you have this pejorative sense of it, then let us spin it around on you and say that if that's what you want to mean by the term, then on your own terms, we're going to say, well, no. Actually, the shoes on the other foot,
My suspicion is that if you actually went and asked Frank Turek and Geisler, they'd probably agree with Tim in terms of how faith should be defined.
Yeah, and so that's, again, the problem. And it's not just a minor semantic problem. It gets back to usage. So if you would agree that some people use the word faith in the way that I'm defining it, then it just becomes an empirical question that one could ascertain through survey data of how many people actually use the word faith this way. So maybe it's just a disagreement in how many and what the numbers are. Like, what percentage of Christians, Tim, do you think use the word faith in the way that I've defined it? Not the pretending, but the first definition.
Something well below 1%. And I'm talking about people across all. I'm talking about people across all levels of academic achievement and study, from people who never got out of high school to people who've got doctorates. People in the churches, people in the pews. Now they may have certain conceptions about what counts as evidence that I wouldn't share or that you wouldn't share. They may think, for example, that a certain kind of inner sense of the fittingness of something is strong evidence, and I might be worried about that. I might think, wow, you know, you're taking that to be evidence, and I might not be wholly on board with that. But they think it is evidence, and they guide their lives by it in ways that shows that what they do not mean is belief without evidence. They just have an alternate conception of what counts as evidence.
I think this is quite important in the sense that I mean, what might be helpful at this point, if you don't mind me moving along a bit, gentlemen, is to get from you, Tim, how you think faith should be defined. Because for you, obviously, it does involve evidence. It's not a blind faith in that sense. If you were to rewrite Peter's book, how would you use the word faith?
Yeah, well, I would say that faith is trusting, holding to, and acting on what one has good reason to believe is true in the face of difficulties. And the difficulties may be that it's something that you're forced to venture on. That is, you're forced to take an action where the outcome is beyond your control. So let me use an example and show the difference between the word faith and the word hope here, right? If I'm skydiving, this is my first time jumping out of a plane, and my instructor packed my parachute for me, I may know that according to the American Parachute Association, 99.9993% of all people who go skydiving reach the ground alive, okay? And yet I may be very apprehensive because I'm about to jump out of a plane. And once I do, whether I get to the ground alive is not something I can wholly control now, right? So I can know all the statistics. I can have a very high probability, but I might still say, I have faith that my instructor packed my parachute correctly. And the way I'll show that is by jumping out of the plane. If all I could say is, I hope that he packed my parachute correctly, unless I'm making a joke, if hope is as far as I go, I'm not going out of the plane. Mm. If it's merely hope and I don't have grounds for it, I'm not going to jump. If it's faith, if I have faith that he did it, I will jump. Now, the jump then places the outcome beyond my control. I can't see into the future in a way that lets me guarantee that I reach the ground alive. There's plenty of evidence that I will. Still, that's a case where I would say the word faith is appropriate and the word hope is not.
Yes, it puts a new spin on the word leap of faith, I suppose. But
right.
What's your thoughts on that particular definition then, Peter, of faith?
Two things. I think what Tim just said is important because I think people use faith and hope as synonyms. And again, in chapter two of the book, I talked about this, and I think we agree on that. They're absolutely not synonyms. I guess two questions then. Where does evidence stop and faith take over? And why does it take over, specifically in the example you just used with the parachute?
Okay, I don't think that's the right way of putting it. I think that when you put it that way, you're prejudicing the outcome of the question as if faith had to, in some sense, make up for some deficiencies in the evidence. The fact of the matter is, when we act, we do things in a complete way. If I think that the probability of my arriving at the ground alive is 67%, I don't pull the ripcord slower, right? When I jump out, I pull it or I don't. I jump or I don't, and those are all-or-nothing acts. My probabilities are what they are, and it's not like I have 33% faith if I had only 67% evidence. That, I think, is a poor way of trying to relate the two concepts. I make an act, or I engage in trusting someone or something, and I do so on the basis of such evidence as I have, but that evidence falls short of a guarantee, and so I take a step out into matters that are beyond my control, but I don't do so blindly.
We're going to have to go to a quick break, gents, and apologies, because we're getting in some really fascinating territory, and we'll let Peter come straight back, because I think this is a really interesting area. You're listening to Unbelievable today. My guests today are Dr. Peter Boghossian and Dr. Tim McGrew.
Do the Bible and science really contradict each other? Is there really a historical Adam and Eve? These are only a few of the questions that seem to indicate an apparent conflict between science and faith, and this is why Reasons to Believe exists. RTB's mission is to demonstrate that sound reason and scientific research consistently support, rather than erode, confidence in the truth of the Bible. Our work shows how the record of nature and the record of Scripture reveal the God of the Bible as Creator, Lord, and Savior. Find out how you also can give a skeptical world reasons to believe. Visit us today at reasons.org.
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
We'll be getting into the second part of our debate between Peter Boghossian and Tim McGrew in just a moment's time. We've had a cracking start to it, haven't we? But just a quick reminder, if you're interested in these issues around how to engage with atheism, for instance, then I do welcome you along, of course, to Unbelievable, the conference 2014. Open to Christians and non-Christians, but certainly a place where you'll be able to engage with some of the top Christian thinkers from around the world, all converging on London on Saturday, the 12th of July, for a special day of training. It's called Reasonable Faith in an Uncertain World. We're doing it in conjunction with Biola University this year and in association with Reasons to Believe. Some of their speakers coming over for that. We've got people like William Lane Craig and Oz Guinness on the bill, and just a whole hunk of topics that we're going to be debating and looking at through the course of the day on Saturday the 12th of July. Book in at premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith, and there you'll find the Facebook video as well. If you want to share that around, you're welcome to do so. Gives you an idea of what's coming up. It's me strolling around the magnificent venue of Westminster Central Hall, looking pensive and dramatic, so you'll want to go and watch that too if you go to the site premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. Okay, let's pick up our debate again. We're talking about whether faith is a false epistemology, a false way of knowing things. My guest today, Dr. Peter Boghossian, the author of A Manual for Creating Atheists, and Dr. Tim McGrew, who's a philosophy professor at Western Michigan University. Just coming back then, I mean, I think we've had some really interesting stuff there in terms of tossing around this definition of faith. And we heard Tim giving that definition then, Peter, which is about trusting in something on the basis of evidence, and in that sense we have faith in many things, and it's no different to say that faith in God is something based in evidence. And yes, we may disagree about the evidence, and someone's evidence may, as it turns out, to be pretty poor evidence, you know, in many ways, but that's not to say that the definition therefore is about believing without evidence, because that would kind of, I suppose, be more like just trying to imagine something to be true rather than faith. So what's your response on this one?
Yeah, thanks. So the first thing is, what a place for a break. The first thing is that, as I said before, that's not how people use it. We have a substantive disagreement over the percentage of people who use it. But to speak to his example directly, so I don't know Tim personally, but let's just assume for a moment that he actually does jump out of planes with parachutes, and the degree of confidence, and let's just say, just except by fiat, just for the purpose of this conversation, I have no idea what the percentage of deaths is from jumping out of a plane or parachute, but let's just say that it's, you know, 99.999% sure that you live, like a 0.001% chance that you're going to die. So whether or not the instructor packs your parachute, lots of considerations would go into that. Do you know this person? Is he a family friend? Do you trust him? Did he ever pack parachutes before? How long has he been doing that? And you can make a decision about whether or not you should let this woman or guy or whatever the gender of the person is pack your parachute based upon the best available evidence. You don't need to assign a higher confidence value to that piece of evidence. You don't need to use the word faith in there. I mean, look, you can think about it. You can think about it in a number of ways. Why don't we have faith in the existence of chickens? I mean, why don't we use the word faith in that context? Nobody ever says they know chickens exist because they have faith.
Can I respond here, Peter?
Yeah, sure. Go ahead.
So, again, notice what you're doing. You're trying to smuggle in the definition of faith as assigning a higher confidence than the evidence warrants by saying you have this probability, you don't need faith. But that's the definition that is contested here. And when you're smuggling it in like that, you're assuming the point that is supposed to be at issue between us in this part of the conversation. As for the chickens thing, I think there's a very straightforward reason that we don't say that we have faith in the existence of chickens, and that is that we're venturing nothing on the existence of chickens. when I believe that chickens exist, and when I act on that belief, it's not like I am taking any kind of step that places outcomes I care about beyond my direct control, whereas when I dive out of the plane, I am.
So, what to you is the substantive difference between not using the word faith in terms of I have faith in the existence of chickens and using the word faith in terms of I have faith that when I jump out of the plane, if my instructor packed my parachute, I'm going to, you know, not die?
So the example was I have faith that my instructor packed my chute properly, and the difference between them is that in the one case, the act one is taking is a venture that places consequences one cares about, in this case, my arriving at the ground alive, outside of my direct control. And there's no parallel for the existence of chickens.
Now I'm clear. So what does that have to do with the way people use the word faith?
I think it gives a more accurate definition of it. People who have faith are placing things like their eternal destiny, right, the state of their souls, they're taking a kind of a risk where the outcomes matter, things they care about matter, and they're saying, this is not wholly up to me now, I have evidence, and again, we can agree or disagree over whether the evidence that they think they have, they really have, that's an interesting question, I think a much more interesting question, but then they're willing to step out and say, all right, the final outcome depends on this, I've got what evidence I do, I'm making my decision, but the outcome is now out of my control in a way that there's no parallel for in the case of the belief in chickens.
I do want to start us to draw to a close this section of the conversation, because there's other things I'd love to discuss about the book.
I hate to rush you guys, but
okay.
You're killing me.
We'll do a round two, I'm sure. But okay, just a quick response, Peter, and then we'll try to move things on.
Look, I've never packed a parachute in my life. And so, I don't know, you probably wouldn't trust me to pack your parachute because you, I don't know. But if a friend, if my wife
is
jumping...
If you've never packed one, I'm not going to. Yeah.
Yeah, good. Excellent. So you know, it's kind of like the do you trust your wife thing. Like, you know, do I trust her to do what? You know, fly a plane? No, I don't trust her. Nobody in their right mind would want me to pack a parachute for them. And so if I did end up packing a parachute for someone, I don't know the first thing about packing a parachute for someone. If I did pack a parachute for somebody, I can almost guarantee you the outcome would not be good. But if they were to say to me, especially if it weren't a life or death situation, if they were just doing it for yucks and giggles, but if they did say to me, sorry, my rate of speech is fast, I'm trying to say this quickly, but if they did say to me, hey, look, man, pack my parachute, I have faith in you, that would be a legitimate use of the word faith.
Yeah.
And that's exactly how people use the word. Because, Tim, you have studied apologetics and Latin, whatever you've studied. The average churchgoer, the overwhelming bulk of humanity, doesn't have a fraction of your knowledge. And they're not using the word
I suppose, in a sense, Peter, I would say, I've got faith in you that you'll do that. Because I would only say that to a person packing my parachute, if I believe they had the appropriate experience. I wouldn't say it if I didn't believe that. I would say, no, I don't want to pack my, but that isn't
exactly.
That isn't that exactly what Tim's saying, that faith involves believing something on the basis of having reasons for it, you know, evidence and so on.
Right.
And I'm saying that the number of people who use the term that way isn't a fraction of what Tim thinks. The people, and maybe we're just too close. Maybe we shouldn't be talking about Christianity. Maybe, you know, in the Christian context. I mean, what about Muslims who say these things? What about Muslims who say they have faith that Muhammad flew to heaven on a winged horse? That's in Surah 17:1. I'm studying the Quran now. I mean, how do you think Muslims use that word? Do you think that they're using it in the same way?
Okay.
Yeah, in my experience, the Muslims I've talked to think that the Quran itself has such internal marks of veracity and inspiration that it qualifies as evidence for the truth of what it claims. They don't think that it's
exactly
just
right.
Like any other old document. They think, look, you can tell by the literary structures that no mere uneducated man would have been able to produce, you can tell, looking at this, there's evidence that this is an inspired work. And therefore, on the basis of that evidence, they do take the story to be legitimated. Now, we can argue about whether good evidence, and that's an interesting discussion, but they think there's evidence, and that's why they would say they have faith.
Right. Okay, so now the question becomes, do you, Tim, have faith or evidence that, and I'm assuming you don't think Muhammad is rose to heaven in a winged horse, but do you have faith or evidence that Islam is false?
Why would I use the word faith if I'm venturing nothing on Islam? I'm a little bit confused by this framing of the question that way. I think I have evidence that it is false, but since I'm not venturing on Islam, I'm not sure why the word faith would come in.
Okay, so this is an important, in qualitative research, you call emerging theme. This is an emerging theme now. So what does the relationship of venture to – explain venture to me. You said that a few times in relation to the chicken and in relation to the parachute.
Right. To venture something is to engage in a course of action, the outcome of which you care about when the outcome is beyond your direct control. Not to do so necessarily blindly, but to place an outcome you care about at the disposal of factors that are beyond your control.
Okay. So how does that relate to faith, and how does that relate to how people actually use the word faith?
Right. I think when they use the word faith, they're talking about venturing, but I don't think that absence of evidence is for anyone who uses the phrase positively or for nearly anyone. I suppose there's always a few people out there who will believe almost anything, but the vast majority of cases, and apparently the editors of the OED agree with me on this, it's not something that requires an absence of evidence or an absence of sufficient evidence. The evidence might be personal, internal, or so forth, but it's not an absence of it.
I am going to urge you guys to move on, because I there are other things we wanted to talk about as well.
Sure.
But
okay.
Yeah, just maybe. Right. We're adding
a longer conversation.
We do, and so that's why I'm saying let's do round two, maybe in the summer when you're on your vacation, Peter, and time allows.
Because this is exactly what I want to talk about.
Yeah, absolutely. I think we've dug though into a very sort of valid kind of obvious disagreement here. We've reached something of an impasse, but you'd simply have very different working definitions of faith. And I think it's important that we've drawn that out. I mean, before we start to talk about something else, let me say, if you're listening and you'd like to have your say in this, whether you're an atheist, Christian, or somewhere in between, I'd love to hear from you too. Do email in unbelievable@premier.org.uk. You can find today's show on the Unbelievable webpage. That's premier.org.uk/Unbelievable. Links there to the Facebook and Twitter account and so on. Links, of course, to both my guests, where you can find out more about A Manual for Creating Atheists by Peter Boghossian and Dr. Tim McGrew's resources as well. It's a fascinating conversation we're having today on the show.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
So we've been talking about whether faith is a false epistemology. Epistemology means how we come to know things. And both my guests do work in that area of philosophy. Peter Boghossian, though, very much taking the concept to the streets. That's what he wants to do. He wants to help Christians and unbelievers see that the way they believe things simply doesn't make sense. And he believes he can help people to learn how to talk believers out of their faith in that sense. Or that might be at least be what happens once they start to use critical thinking. Now, look, Peter, I mean, you've said about, you know, a number of times already in the course of today's discussion that you're interested in this kind of respectful civil dialogue and so on. But reading your book, there are a few things that leapt out at me that kind of might make you wonder whether that is a sincere thought. Because, for instance, when you say we must reconceptualize faith as a virus of the mind and treat faith like other epidemiological crises, contain and eradicate. And you even go on to suggest that faith should be categorized as a mental illness. You know, once religious or delusions are integrated into the DSM, that's a sort of statistical manual, I think, for medicine, entirely new categories of research and treatment into the problem of faith can be created. This will include removal of existing ethical barriers, changing treatments covered by insurance, including faith-based to special education programs in the schools, helping children who have been indoctrinated into a faith tradition, and legitimizing interventions designed to rid subjects of the faith affliction. I mean,
yes, that's in chapter 9.
Yeah,
chapter nine
and those are strong words. I mean, you are basically saying Christian faith is a virus of the mind. It's a delusion. It's something that people should be medically helped to be rid of. I mean, that sounds a bit more than, you know, a nice sort of civil chat kind of thing.
Well, first of all, I think it's very unfair, frankly, for you to say that I characterize just Christian faith. I go to great lengths in the book to give examples of all faith traditions, and I think that the criticism that I specifically single out and target Christian faith is just simply false. And for anyone who had that idea that I've just targeted Christian faith, I can tell you unequivocally that that's not all true. I'm equally hostile to all faith traditions, maybe even Scientology more than most. But so my intent isn't to demean anybody, though negative feelings could certainly be the byproduct of engaging ideas, particularly if people aren't used to engaging ideas. I actually think that the opposite is true. I address people sincerely and bluntly as adults. You could also look at it this way before we talk about the DSM, which you said is the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders. Think about, and since you used Christian, I'll also use Christian in this context. Think about how Muslims feel or atheists feel when either they're told explicitly through radio shows or in conversations that they're going to burn in hell and along with their children for eternity. Think about homosexuals who are told that they can't adopt children because of the way that they're wired. Think about the results or the effects on real people who have become hurt by this. So to the DSM, yeah, so what's going on there? What you said needs to be unpacked a little bit. So and maybe Tim and I could find some disagreement on this if we look at other faith traditions like Islam or Scientology and raising children in these delusions. So maybe we can reach some agreement that these are actually mental disorders. If you look at the DSM right now, the DSM gives, which is basically a political exemption or an exemption for religious-based delusions, precisely because of that they're religious-based delusions. It's an interesting thing. Articles in literature, they don't use the word political correctness, but that's the basic idea. So that is impinging on science, and that's preventing us from helping people through these afflictions.
So you do believe, though, effectively, faith, be it Christian, Islamic, Scientology or whatever, is in effect a mental affliction, something we would want to medically treat, you know, eradicate, as you say.
I think that faith itself is the problem. And I think that what we have now is you can look at it like a buddy of mine, James Lindsay, said that it hijacks the reasoning process. It's like I write in the book extensively about the analogy to how it spreads like an epistemic virus.
Right.
And you can think about it in terms of computer code. You know, one's reasoning process is akin to a code that analyzes incoming information and allows one to make a decision. And faith is like having a corrupted code in the program that distorts the process.
Okay. So kind of like a virus, like, you know, that's the kind of the idea, isn't it?
We need to help people through these delusions that they have. And now we can bracket, if Christianity is too close, we can bracket this and we can just look at some pretty extreme examples of faith traditions in which Muslim extremists like Wahhabism in Saudi Arabia or Scientology, which is an extraordinarily pernicious strain of the virus. We can look at those and maybe Tim and I
sure.
can reach agreement.
Well let's talk about those because I think it's important to distinguish what we're talking about here. And obviously when I presume, you know, to be fair to Peter, he's thinking of those extremes, if you like, the faith that makes people fly airplanes into buildings and that kind of thing, Tim. But what's your take on this?
Yeah, I guess I am still not finding a point of agreement here with Peter. It seems to me that what he's doing is trying to define, and I grant his point that he's talking about various sorts of faiths, various religions, but that to define it in this way is to reduce disagreement to derision. And I find that very puzzling as a technique for opening dialogue. I disagree with Muslims. I don't feel a need to deride them by defining them into intellectual inferiority by saying that they're believing without evidence or that they have, that they're pretending to know things they don't know. I think they're wrong. But I think that it's a better way to open a conversation to say, let's talk about the evidence that you're right. I mean, imagine that the shoe is on the other foot. Suppose I define an atheist as a person who either is ignorant of or has misevaluated the evidence for the existence of God. Now, I imagine that Peter would object, and I think he should. Even if it were a true description of all atheists, and I think, in fact, that it is a true description, it's a lousy definition, and it's a terrible way to open a conversation. And if I were to use that definition, the atheists ought to jump all over me, because that would be an example of indoctrination and propaganda. This definition of your target as intellectually inferior, that's what propagandists do. They try to demean and diminish and even dehumanize the opposition by defining them as intellectually inferior, defined as unworthy of rational engagement.
Okay, well, let's allow Peter to respond, yeah.
Okay, so in terms of, you know, Tim mentioned this is a terrible way to open a conversation. He's absolutely correct. That's why I put that in Chapter 9. And nowhere in the book do I advocate when people speak to people of faith that the DSM come into play in those conversations. The Chapter 9 is called containment protocols, and these are macro strategies, intervention strategies, by which we can contain, at the very least, contain and ultimately eradicate the faith virus. But he's correct in that in one-on-one interactions, I absolutely positively am opposed to name-calling, calling, saying that people have a mental disorder.
But so you do say in Chapter 9, that is your belief, though, ultimately.
That is not an intervention strategy. That's a macro containment strategy.
Tim?
Yeah, well, I mean, before Chapter 9 comes Chapter 2, right? That's the one where you've got the definition of faith as a secondary definition, you say, but one that you've also used, say, as a title for your talk for the Humanists of Greater Portland in May of 2012, pretending to know things you don't know.
Yeah, we should talk about that.
Yeah, but it seems to me that as a strategy, that's almost Orwellian. I mean, have you read George Orwell's piece on Newspeak, The Principles of Newspeak, right? I mean, the elimination of undesirable words and the substitution of other definitions is characteristic of this kind of thought control through language control.
Okay, so here's the difference. So when I give a public lecture, like tonight I'll be presenting on a chapter that I wrote for John Loftus's book, Christianity is Not Great, Why Faith Fails. I would give both of you front row seats if you're in Portland. When I present on that, I am not giving an intervention. I am not attempting to – I'm presenting a hybrid academic and popular paper. When you hear things like people on the Colbert Report or Bill Maher, they're – making fun of this, satirizing and ridiculing religion, and I think that certainly has its role. When I give my public lectures or the title or the Jesus, the Easter Bunny, or the delusions, just say no, and those are, you know, not selling anything, those are free on YouTube. That's very, very different from a one-on-one personal micro-engagement that we have that when I try to intervene in my interlocutor's thought process to help him reason more effectively. They're just different categories of things.
I mean, but even the term interventions sort of has connotations, obviously, of people who, you know, are in a cult, basically, and they've been brainwashed.
Well, yeah, because people suffering from faith are not well.
Okay, so you're saying that people who believe in God are basically mentally deluded.
No.
They're not well in some way. Is that?
No.
Okay.
So we need to step back. That's why. And Tim was right to focus so much of the attention on the conversation to Chapter 2, because it's really essential for what we're talking about here. And it's really essential for how people use these words and the types of forms of lives that people trap themselves into. And it's actually made worse by Christian apologetics, or any apologetics for that matter.
Well, I would have thought Christian apologetics is at least, done well at least, is helping people to use their critical reasoning faculties and so on. I mean, Tim, obviously,
it's a form of insincerity, and it's also a form of confirmation bias, because one would have to thoroughly examine the superstitions of every tradition before deciding to believe one. But it's a form of insincerity because people start with the belief that they have the truth and they try to defend that rather than holding belief revision as a virtue.
Right. What's your thought on that? Again, another definition of what Christian apologetics is about, Tim.
Right. Well, I just don't see Peter's definition as being a legitimate definition at all. It seems to me to be another instance of, at best, a pretty serious misunderstanding of what's going on. Now, there are some people, no doubt, who start out with various positions, including atheism, with no intention of changing their minds, no matter what evidence is presented. And in several
that's
of his
true.
Public
that's
presentations,
true.
Peter has denied that that's where he wants to go. And so I just don't see it that way. I think apologetics, like any other inquiry where you don't start out from a blank slate, from a sort of Lockean tabula rasa, is a case where you have a conviction, you have some evidence, you're interested in seeing whether it holds up or doesn't hold up, and if it spectacularly fails on the whole to explain the total evidence that you can accumulate, you will give it up. Now, not everyone wants to do that.
I'm not trying to put you on the spot or invoke anything defensive in you, but have you read the Quran?
I have. And I've read the Upanishads and the Bhagavad Gita and a number of other works. But I want to say something about the way that you raised that a moment ago. I don't think that it's any more... Hold it. Hold it. I don't think that it's any more necessary to make a detailed scholarly study of every religious tradition before coming to a settled belief that one is true than it is necessary to investigate the biography of every person who was alive at the time Lincoln was shot before you could settle on the conclusion that John Wilkes Booth shot him. You're taking a case where you're pretending that you can't have good evidence for one thing unless you've surveyed everything and found that there's no evidence for the other. That's just not the way that we operate in many dimensions of evidential evaluation. I can have good reason for thinking that general relativity is true without having surveyed every logically possible alternative to general relativity. So in science, in forensics, in history, in all kinds of cases, we don't have to rule out all alternatives. We simply have to have a good case that one is true on the whole, and a case where we have made our effort to overcome confirmation bias by looking at what has been and can be said against it to the best of our ability.
We're going to have to take a quick break, and I know Peter's going to hate that because he wants to leap straight back in, but we'll come back to conclude this conversation on Peter's book, A Manual for Creating Atheists.
Was Jesus really raised from the dead? How can we know that God exists? How do we explain evil, pain and suffering in the world? And can faith be reconciled with modern science? Few universities are bold enough to answer yes to all these questions, but California's Biola University is premier amongst them. Biola University offers distance learning graduate degrees in theology, science, and apologetics that answer the toughest questions people ask about your faith. So to get the confidence you need to stand for Christ in a cynical age, visit biola.edu/apologetics. That's biola.edu/apologetics.
I'm Justin Bridie. Welcome back. It's Unbelievable, the third and final part of today's programme. Part of Faith Explored every Saturday afternoon, where we help you to think through your faith here on Premier Christian Radio. And to help you continue to do that later on this afternoon in the profile, Charles Whitehead speaks to Lucinda van der Hart of Premier Christianity magazine. He's one of the leading figures in the UK in the Catholic Charismatic movement, and he's going to be talking about things like his time spent with Pope Francis and whether the Pope is a charismatic. It's all part of our Revolution in Rome theme here on Premier Christian Radio throughout the month of May. You want to find out more about that? Go to premier.org.uk/Rome. And picking up that theme next week on Unbelievable, going to be doing a Catholic debate. First time I think we've done actually two Catholics, as it were, debating each other, though one Catholic might question whether the other deserves to be called a Catholic. Peter D. Williams is a more conservative voice. He's going to be in conversation with Hans Küng, who's a controversial Catholic theologian and priest who has made radical calls for reform within the Catholic Church in terms of women being ordained, open communion table, sexuality and all kinds of other areas. And you'll be hearing their debate on whether the Catholic Church needs to modernise next week. So come back for that between 2:30 and 4, and also online at premier.org.uk slash unbelievable. Also, later on in today's show, as well as hearing your feedback, I'm going to be airing a little bit of my conversation with NASA astronaut Jim Dutton. Extraordinary man. He's been on the International Space Station. He's a fighter test pilot. He's part of an event coming up in 2 weeks' time here in the UK at Clyde Auditorium called In Concert with the Cosmos. So listen out for that as well shortly after we've finished today's discussion. We're talking today, of course, to Peter Boghossian. He's the author of A Manual for Creating Atheists, and Dr. Tim McGrew. Finishing up our conversation with them, we've been asking today, is faith a false epistemology? Is faith about pretending to know what you actually don't know?
You're listening to Unbelievable on Premier Christian Radio.
Okay, so Peter, you know, obviously Tim McGrew takes, you know, a lot of problems from your book. He feels that you've mystified.
He's not a fan.
He's not a fan, no. You probably won't be putting him on the blurb of your next one, that's for sure. But either way, do you feel that anything he said stands up, that you have misrepresented faith, that you have misrepresented the way people come to their beliefs as Christians and so on? Or do
no,
you...
I think anybody who sincerely listened to this conversation knows exactly that I'm correct and that this is how the overwhelming majority of people have it. Very sincere people will say once you start talking to them, and you know, maybe not the 50 or 65, 70 people that Tim engages on a regular basis who have apologetics training, but they'll see that the way that I've defined faith is exactly the way that people use the word when they're being sincere. And the only time one needs to really use that word is when one doesn't have sufficient evidence. I really wish this conversation were longer. I'd like to specifically like to talk about the plane example.
It's the move
on the chessboard that people make when the evidence isn't available.
Well, look, let's do it again at some point. I hope you'll keep the door open to this dialogue, Peter. And what would be great as well is what we didn't get to today, which is actually discussing the evidence that people like Tim and others do use for the existence of God, why they would say their faith is rationally grounded.
That's a whole other conversation.
But it'd be interesting to open up. You know, we've talked a lot about whether the definitions here, but what is the evidence?
I'd also really like to know. Go ahead.
No, I was just going to say. Well, maybe that's something for next time. But do carry on, and we'll let you go.
Yeah. So I really would like to know from listeners on your blog, and I'll look in your blog. You have a blog, right?
It's more of a web page, and I have the Facebook page where a lot of people then comment on the show.
Okay. So. Yeah, I really like believers and non-believers to just chime in, and in their conversations, is Tim right that this is less than 1%, under 1% of the people, or am I correct, and that this is how the vast majority of humanity, and if you want to say it in a Christian context, that's fine too,
okay,
how the vast majority of Christians use the word.
Well, I'll tell
and
you
I
what.
I think if you're really...
What we'll do is it's very easy on Facebook to set up a poll, and obviously that will depend on who's responding to the poll, but let's set up a poll and we'll give the two definitions, and I'll check that you're both happy with the definition,
and
we'll say...
Do people use the word when they don't have... Yeah.
Yeah,
That's right.
It would be interesting. Obviously, that is not definitive, but it would be an interesting straw poll on how people tend to regard the use of the word faith. It's obviously been very important.
Does the word when people use it in daily conversations reflect a leap beyond what's warranted by the evidence?
A leap beyond what is warranted by the evidence. Okay,
that's one.
Yeah.
All right.
Thank you so much for being with us today, Peter. It's been really fascinating to have you
on. My pleasure. Thanks, Tim. And if you're in Portland... You'd be my guest. I know that we have very different fundamental substantive disagreements about the nature of reality, but I would hope, you know, Phil Vischer and I have continued a conversation online. I would hope that that would not impact anything in terms
of
the...
Well, look,
Peter, thanks for the conversation.
It's been great, and the door is open to both of you to come back and for a round two, because it always goes so fast, doesn't it? Thank you very much, Peter, for coming on the program. Really appreciate you being on. If you want more information on Peter, peterboghossian.com, or just type his name into Google. That's usually the easiest way, isn't it? Okay, Tim, just final few words as we start to wrap up today's show.
Yeah, I mean, Peter's very sure about how Christians intend the word to be used, and I think it would be interesting in your poll if you were to separate it out into two polls. One poll for people who don't identify as Christians and ask them how they think Christians use the word and what they think Christians mean by it, not whether Christians believe without evidence, but whether Christians mean that they believe without evidence when they say that they have faith. And another poll for Christians to say whether they mean that they believe without evidence. Oh, there are some fideists out there, but I think you'll find that they are in an overwhelming minority. And so it'll be interesting to see, you know, unscientific poll, but still the way it is. The other thing is, if this is really, if Peter's really right about the way that this is done, I think he needs to contact the editors of the OED and ask them to change their definition, because I'm not sure how they got it so far wrong if that is the fundamental meaning of the word. But that's a, yeah, that's something for him to work out with the editors at the OED.
Okay, well, look, you know, let's do it. Right now, go to the Unbelievable Facebook page. I'm going to make sure it's all set up there as by Saturday as this show broadcasts. That's facebook.com/unbelievablejb. We're going to do a straw poll on the definition of faith, and we'll make sure to split it out between non-Christians and Christians as to how they view their own take on that word. Fascinating to have you on, Tim. I wanted to have you on as well, and this was a great opportunity to do it, and I hope you've enjoyed today's program.
Thanks very much, Justin. It was a lot of fun.
Great stuff. Thanks for being on. And who knows, we may see Tim and Peter again in the future. It sounds like Peter was very much up for a part two, so we'll see what we can pull together. Thank you for listening as well. If you want to get in touch about anything you've heard on today's program, as ever, you can email in. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter, and I'm going to give you all of those links. And we've got plenty of time for your feedback as well in the next part of today's program. So do keep listening to Unbelievable here on Premier Christian Radio, part of Faith Explored, every Saturday.
Unbelievable with Justin Brierley.
Okay, well, let's look at some of your feedback, first of all. And someone gets in touch to say that they want to flag up, knowing that we were having this debate today between Peter and Tim, that there's a useful resource at biblicalscholarship.wordpress.com, Reviews of a Manual for Creating Atheists by Peter Boghossian. There's a link there to a number of reviews written, considerably lengthy replies to Boghossian's book. And so I will put a link to that website and where you can find that with today's programme, as you've asked me to. Also, a number of replies to the programme last week. David John, under the radar healing evangelist in the Middle East, was in discussion with atheist Jeff Lillis and talking about their own experience wandering the streets of Dublin praying for people. Faiz Ahmad said, "What a pathetic attempt to woe Christ worshippers by bogus healing among Muslims in the Middle East. Why doesn't that healing work for Jesus believers who are affected by cancer, Christian kids dying in their millions, or AIDS hit Christian children in Africa? Ridiculous," says Faiz. Whereas Tom Dell says, "I can think of worse things to do than go around praying with and for people. I wouldn't necessarily use the same techniques as David, and I think his understanding of a word of knowledge isn't supported by true biblical exegesis, but I wouldn't want to stop him, especially if he is living out the gospel of Christ." Amy Fraser-Child says, "I love that David is loving people. I'm kind of disappointed that God doesn't have a 100% success rate. That seems strange if it truly is him behind the phenomenon. Also, David's ministry is keeping records, but he's not analysing them. I'd kind of like to know the p-value of those findings. Just saying." David Kirkland says, "I've listened to a lot of shows, but this one was an excellent dialogue. I really want to applaud Jeff Lillis for the way he conducted himself. His tone being reasonable and open-minded and not simply resorting to snark and insults. Seriously, he is an atheist skeptic I can respect, and I think there can be an excellent continued debate and dialogue with conversations like this example." And Joshua Grieve also comments on that, says, "Are all Irish skeptics kind and fair souls? First David Beebe, now Jeff Lillis. As a Christian, I have to say, I really enjoy that what these two guys bring to the discussion." Thank you very much for that. All those comments were on our Facebook page after I posted the show up there last week. Lots of emails flying in as well on that show via email as well. Maybe just time for a couple. Here's first of all, Tim Hull, who says, "Can I point out something blindingly obvious? If there was just one person that was really healed, one miracle, one case that doctors pointed to the supernatural, then your atheist guest Jeff would have to do something with that. It's not about a percentage at all. i.e., you know, how many people say they got better. It's about one time. There could be one supernatural event, and that alone would have to send the worldview of an atheist into a tizzy. All you need is one. The fact that there are some 1,100, some stronger, I would guess, than others, are great odds for one being really supernatural and therefore God, says Tim. But whereas other people, very different views on this, James says, I had so many issues with David John's assertions, but tantamount to all of them is that Muslims are believers too and may be expecting something supernatural. So why pray for healing at all? If your life, the good and the bad, is all God's will or part of his larger plan, then isn't asking to be healed really asking God to change his plan for you? As a believer, shouldn't you accept any illness as divine order? And if so, why ask to change it? Well, that kind of depends a lot on your theology there, James, I'd suppose. And I'm pretty sure that David John isn't in that sense a Calvinist, believing that you sort of are dealt the hand and you live with it. I think he sort of sees this as a spiritual battle in many ways, a real ongoing one in the real world, being fought in real time in a sense. But even a Calvinist wouldn't say, therefore, that, you know, someone who is experiencing illness has to therefore accept it as the will of God, that, that healing may be part of the plan of God, and that might involve people like David John. Who knows? Going to have to draw a little close to that there. So much more I'd like to read out from the emails and also to the Chalk versus Wilson debates that I put online as well a couple of weeks ago. Lots of response, but time it won't allow for the moment. Just enough time to say I'd love you to come along to Unbelievable, the conference, of course. Just a reminder of that, that if you want to book in, really worth doing now. Why not bring a group from your church? We've got group discounts and we've got special offers if you book two or more tickets anyway on getting the free DVD. Loads of great topics, loads of great speakers. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. So pleased to be partnering with Biola University this year and in association with Reasons to Believe. And it's really going to be a day worth getting along to on Saturday the 12th of July. premier.org.uk/reasonablefaith. But we like to champion anything here on the show that we think is really worth attending. And I'm actually going to be involved in an event up in Scotland at the Clyde Auditorium in Glasgow this coming Saturday, the 7th of June. I'll be emceeing this event, and it's going to include people like Professor John Lennox, a full orchestra, and astronaut James Dutton. Well, I spoke to James about his life and faith recently. I'm just going to play out a little bit of our interview. You can hear the full thing next week on the profile on Saturday. But this is a bit about me talking to him about being an astronaut and a Christian, and his time spent flying to the International Space Station, whether it was anything like the film Gravity with George Clooney and Sandra Bullock. Here's his response on that, and talking about the event he's coming to as well.
Well, that's a great question, because you know, it's easy for people to forget that I think that the mission is so scripted, and there is we have a timeline essentially broken into 5-minute increments that covers the entire mission.
Wow.
And so you know what you're doing every day, and there is a significant amount of performance pressure. You know everyone's watching from mission control and the astronaut office, and you want to get it done right. People who know the details and the intricacies of what you're conducting and have the insight through the instrumentation that pipes it down to mission control. And so
basically the larking about that George Clooney did is probably not that realistic in reality.
Right. There was a lot of good Hollywood stuff in there too. You know, my wife actually laughed out loud with me when George Clooney asked Sandra Bullock, you know, if she was married, because by the time you end up in space, your crew is like your family. So, yeah. You know, you probably know too much about them. But it was all in good fun. You know, I mean, yeah. That was the movie, but I think for me, that it was neat. We had three rookies on our flight, and it was the last shuttle mission with rookies because they were concerned that some of those later missions might potentially go unfunded and not fly. And so the astronaut office treated us very well. I mean, they worked very hard to get our class in early enough to make sure we had a chance. And we were originally told when we were hired that we would not fly on the shuttle. Mm. There would not be seats for us. So we were very grateful. But I think that knowing this would be the one time I would fly in the space shuttle helped me to have the perspective that as busy as I was going to be up there, I was going to take time to smell the roses, so to speak. Yeah. And smelling the roses up there doesn't involve your nose, actually involves your eyes. there's no roses to smell, but looking out the window is the way that you really absorb the experience. And I spent a lot of time down in a module that's called the cupola that was flown up on the previous mission. So we were very fortunate that we arrived just after this module was added. And the best way to describe it, it was like a glass bottom boat looking down at the earth.
Mm.
You climb into, it's not very big, but it's surrounded by windows on all sides. And I remember on flight day 5, I must have looked when I first woke up at the flight track. It shows on a map, you know, what your ground track will be over the earth for the next few orbits. And I saw that in about an hour, we were going to be coming up on the UK. And I thought, oh, it'd be great. You know, what are the chances, though? It was April, mid-April. I'm like, what are the chances that I'll see ground and not clouds? But I went into the cupola early. I wanted to watch as first Ireland and then the United Kingdom crested over the horizon. And the flight path was going to take us just south of the UK and the English Channel and right over France and down north of Italy and across the Sinai Peninsula. And so I thought, it's during my personal time when you're supposed to be eating breakfast and that kind of thing. I'm going to go watch this view. Well, I was blown away. The only clouds, of course, were right across the English Channel, but everything on the ground was visible in Ireland and the United Kingdom and the continent.
Yeah.
And I could pick out the Wash, which was just north of East Anglia, where we used to fly past all the time. And, you know, the cities are very hard to see. They blend in with the countryside. So it was hard to find London.
Yeah.
But the prominent landmarks that stand out, you know, all across the country is the different peninsulas and so forth. Yeah. It was just phenomenally beautiful.
You had the original Google Earth experience, as it were. Well,
yeah, I mean, you know, on previous spacecraft, we never really had the opportunity to see 360 degrees and to watch something crest the horizon as you're moving at 300 miles a minute. You know, I think that entire ground track from Ireland to being off of the Sinai Peninsula took about 15 minutes, if I recall right.
I mean, having that perspective on the world, having that perspective on the universe, I mean, does it kind of bring home afresh, you know, that Psalm 19, the heavens declare the glory of God, the skies proclaim the work of his hands. Was that something that you kind of felt at that moment as you had that experience of the awe of this experience?
Absolutely. I did not have a spiritual epiphany kind of moment up there. I've told many people what I felt like I was taking in was I felt like a data recorder just recording the most unbelievable experience ever. And it was too overwhelming to process it while recording at the same time. So I did absolutely think many times, I'm like, this is a perspective that, you know, well, very similar flying too, that human beings naturally would not experience, that we've had to stretch beyond. And yet it's one that God looks down and sees all the time. And as I crossed continents, you know, I often thought about the fact that all those people living down there, all with their own lives, all going about their days, there's somebody being born, someone dying, you know, everything and everything under the sun going on in each corner of this planet all the time. And it really made me stop to contemplate, you know, just how great a God we have who can be not only the creator of all that, but who very clearly claims in his word and in my own personal experience as well to be a personal God who knows and loves each of us and says that he knit us together in our womb, in our mother's womb, and knows every hair in our head and is personally involved in each of our stories. You know, that was just all the more brought home to me from that vantage point to go by continents where I knew I was literally looking down on tens of millions of people.
And when it comes to that whole science and faith debate, being someone who's, as it were, looked from that unique perspective at the world and the universe, that gives you a different way of just approaching that whole debate.
Well, it certainly opened the door in the sense of people are very fascinated by the experience of flying in space and what the perspective was like. And I don't know that it's the experience itself has made me any more qualified to address the issue, but at least it's provided an opportunity to raise the questions and to ask people to consider, you know, from a scientific standpoint, is it really exclusive of mm-hmm. God being there? For me, I find the two extremely compatible. And I absolutely do not feel like I could or would be willing to check in my brain at the door if that was what I was called to do as a Christian. But as I've dug into the Bible more and more, you know, I've found it to be very robust. And so the paradigm of our day often contradicts it. But when I have read and obviously there's very intelligent Christians out there in the sciences and that have done a lot of writing and research. And so I guess, you know, we'll get to go into more of that during the time that I'm there. I'm excited about that because I think as Christians, you know, we've been told that we have to be embarrassed about the fact that we're Christians if we're scientists because the two don't fit. And I don't see that. And the more I dig and the more I read and look at the data, I believe that, you know, in both cases, anytime you're looking back and trying to figure out what happened, you've stepped beyond the realm of hypothesis, test, and examine results. You're now projecting, you're extrapolating the data backwards in time. And there's different directions it can go based on the assumptions you make.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah. So what's your hopes then in terms of you're coming over shortly for this event on the 7th of June? And as I say, alongside others who will be speaking, Professor John Lennox, I'll be hosting, and there's going to be visuals. There's going to be wonderful music from Tenors Unlimited and indeed a whole orchestra. We're really looking forward to this. It's kind of a very much a meld of aesthetic, music, visual, and the science as well. What do you see as your place within that and what you're hoping to bring to the party, Jim?
Oh, gosh, I don't know what my place is, but just to tell you what I'm excited about with it is that, you know, we homeschooled for a number of years, and I'm certainly not, I don't consider myself a professional educator, but I learned something about the classical education, and I see this event as very representative of what classical education teaches in the Christian sense, which is we see that every aspect of this world, every aspect points back to God. God is at the center of it all. So whether you're talking about mathematics, history, music, literature, science, they all connect at the center with God. And so I think this evening with the music and the visuals that we're going to see, you know, I can't look at those pictures from the Hubble Space Telescope and not see God in the majesty of the art of what you see in the cosmos. And Dr. Lennox is one of my favorites to listen to. He has been among many men that are Christian believers in the sciences. He's one of the foremost that I believe articulates well the compatibility between the Christian faith and science. So I've really enjoyed listening to him in the past. I'm excited to meet him for the first time. I think that, you know, the event is really going to give a great broad perspective of the integrity of the Christian faith.
Well, thank you so much for talking to me today, Jim. And I'm looking forward to meeting you at the event as well, of course. And
yes, likewise.
And if you're listening and you'd like to find out more about it, it's called In Concert with the Cosmos. Jim is one among a number of different things happening on that night at the Clyde Auditorium in Scotland. thegodquestion.tv/cosmos if you want to find out more about that and book in for it Saturday the 7th of June. I think it's going to be a wonderful evening and I'm really looking forward to it personally. Jim, thank you very much for being my guest on The Profile today, and it's been so good to hear about all that you've been involved in. Very exciting as well. And all the very best as you continue in your life.
Thank you, Justin. God bless you.
Well, I really hope you've enjoyed today's program, and I hope you can come back at the same time next week. Let me tell you what's coming up then.
You're unbelievable.
Peter D. Williams and a very liberal Catholic theologian Hans Küng are in debate next week about the future of the Catholic Church, all part of our Revolution in Rome theme here in May on Premier Christian Radio. Do look out for that, a really fantastic debate. First time we've really had an inter-Catholic debate as well on the programme, so something of a first for Unbelievable. But a very prominent theologian, highly controversial as I say, Hans Küng, and hear what he has to say about the new Pope and his first year in office next week on the programme. And another influential Catholic coming up next here on Premier Christian Radio, as Lucinda van der Hart speaks to Charles Whitehead about life in the leadership of the Catholic Charismatic Movement. For the moment, here on Unbelievable, thank you for being with me, and we'll see you next time.
Welcome to another round of Boardroom or Miro Board. Today we talk retrospectives with Agile coach Maria. Let's go. First question. You've spent 2 hours in a team retro, but the only input you've heard is Dave's. Boardroom or Miro Board?
Boardroom. In Miro, Dave can't hog the space because everyone can add thoughts anonymously, online at the same time.
Correct. Next. You need the team to act on feedback fast, so you turn all those retro notes into Jira tasks instantly.
Miro all the way. And I can assign those tasks to teammates.
You're nailing this. Now, you see hundreds of sticky notes from the retro. A real mess. But you organize them into 5 themes in just seconds.
Miro, I basically get back an entire hour when I use its AI tools for clustering.
And she's done it.
Join over 60 million people running actually enjoyable and actionable retros in Miro. Get your first 3 boards free at Miro.com. That's M-I-R-O.com.